How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
The next call I got was about 12:40. He had a very non-emotional voice. I got a very taunting, scary type, creepy feeling from the call.
Welcome back, friend. As the night of July 4th, 1969, ticked over into July 5th, fireworks and celebrations began to settle down across the city of Vallejo in California. But for two people in those moments, their lives had been destroyed and changed forever in the most violent of ways. Blue Rock Springs is a beautiful parkland that spanned over 40 acres. Located on Columbus Parkway in Vallejo, it's filled with walking trails and nature. It was a peaceful and local escape from city life. At night, however, the park took on a different persona. Dark with only a few scattered lights, the location provided gloom and shadows that lent themselves only too well to the scenario that played out at the spot in 1969. Like the turnout on Lake Herman Road, Blue Rock Springs was a well-known Lover's Lane area for local teens. Now on this night, full of celebration and cheer, once again, heinous and vicious violence had taken over. Nancy Slover was a police dispatcher for the Vallejo Police Department. On July 4th, 1969, she had worked from 2:30 that afternoon to 10:30 that night. But instead of heading home, she stayed on. It was a busy night with the 4th of July celebrations, so she stayed to help answer the extra calls and get dispatch information out to officers on the ground. At 12:10 in the morning, she answered a call from a hysterical female teenager who said she and two friends had just found two older teens shot at Blue Rock Springs Park. As the dispatch call went out, Ed Rust, a plainclothes Vallejo detective, and his partner heard the sketchy details over the radio. They were on a late shift that night and immediately headed over to the area to investigate. When they got there, they found Officer Richard Hoffman bent down tending to a teenage male, lying on his back, who was conscious but clearly in severe pain. He was lying on the ground next to a brown 1963 Chevrolet Corvair vehicle. As Russ looked up through the open passenger window, he saw a young woman in the driver's seat who had also been shot multiple times and was covered in blood. Her head rested awkwardly on the driver's door near the window. She had gunshot wounds to her upper right arm and on her right side. The young woman was alive, but only barely, and she was unable to communicate with him at all. Emergency medics worked on both victims, moving them into ambulances for critical aid as they were rushed to the hospital. Officer Hoffman traveled with them in the ambulance, increasingly aware of the echoing silence from both victims. His mind traveled back 6 months to Lake Herman Road and the young couple, Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday, who had been shot and killed there. That location was a mere 4 miles away from Blue Rock Springs. Just like at Lake Herman, patrol officers had only been past the Blue Rock Springs parking lot, checking all was well just 30 minutes before the emergency calls came in. One of them had been Officer Hoffman himself. In that time window, since he left the area, two people had been shot multiple times and left for dead.
The young woman in the driver's seat of the Corvair was 22-year-old Darlene Ferrin. She was the mother of a baby daughter, married, and worked as a waitress at a local diner. Earlier that evening, she and her younger sister, Christina, had spent time at Caesar's restaurant, where her husband, Dean, worked. Dean's boss, Bill Lee, had called Darlene at home around 11:30 p.m. that night, asking her if she could find a fireworks store still open. He and Dean were planning a small party at the house after they'd locked up the restaurant. Darlene had tidied up her home a little in preparation for the guests and told the two girls babysitting her daughter she would be back around 12:30 a.m. When Dean got back with his boss and a few friends around 1:30 a.m, he gave the babysitters a lift home. Darlene was often out late, so he didn't think much of her absence at first. He had no idea that 6 miles away, an hour and a half earlier, his wife had met a terrible fate. The young man with Darlene was 19-year-old Michael Renaud Maggio. He had a close friendship with Darlene, and the pair had arranged to meet that night when Darlene was free. At around 10:30 p.m, Michael got a call from Darlene to say she would be arriving soon. When Darlene had collected Michael from his home on Beechwood Avenue, about 2 miles away from her house, not long after 11:30 p.m., she told him she needed to talk to him about something. Abandoning their plans to find some food at a late-night diner, Michael suggested they go to Blue Park Springs, where they could park and talk. It was a few minutes to midnight when they arrived at the park. As they sat in the car, they were joined in the parking lot by a vehicle full of kids, celebrating July the 4th. They stayed a few minutes laughing and making a lot of noise before driving off again. Their shouts and laughter drowned out in the darkness of the night as they drove away. Within minutes, another car entered the parking lot. It parked a few feet away from Darlene and Michael. The driver turned the headlights off and just sat for a minute, seemingly not doing anything. Then the car reversed and drove away. A simple encounter that would soon become a key part of the events that would unfold. That same car, a similar make and colour to Darlene's, came back into the Blue Rock Springs parking lot within minutes of leaving. Parking about 10 feet away, on the right-hand side of Darlene's car, this time the driver got out of the vehicle. The headlights stayed on, and blindingly bright as the figure moved towards the passenger side where Michael was sitting, with the window rolled down. As he approached, the dark figure pointed a high-powered flashlight at him. Darlene and Michael assumed he was a police officer, began to get their identification documents from their pockets and purse. But as the figure reached the passenger door, keeping the flashlight shining inside, he began to fire a gun straight at them. No words were exchanged, just shot after shot ringing out, the sound bouncing around the interior of the vehicle and out into the darkness. Michael realized he was being shot. After each sound, muffled after the first one, he felt a sharp shooting pain. The gun had been fired right next to his head. His neck and his back were hit first, with breaks from the sharp pain of being shot again and again, coming only when the shooter turned the weapon onto Darlene and began firing repeatedly at her. Michael desperately tried to save himself, and maybe Darlene too, twisted and threw himself into the back of the vehicle, managing to push his body over the seats. The terrifying figure had now started to walk away, and the shooting had stopped. Michael cried out in pain, and it was a noise that seemed to snap the shooter back into kill mode. He came back to the vehicle. He aimed his gun at Michael in the back seat now, and fired twice, hitting him in the leg. He then swung around and fired two more shots at Darlene. Finally, the shooter appeared satisfied, and he silently walked away and returned to his vehicle. Michael couldn't get out of the back of the vehicle. The door handle on the inside was broken, and he couldn't open it. He reached around to open the door from the outside. As the door swung open, he fell out and onto the ground, with pain ripping through his entire body. He heard the shooter's car begin to reverse away. It swung around in a large arc to point at the exit of the park, and then drove away. Darlene was motionless inside the car, with nothing but a faint moan coming from her. Michael lay on the ground, wondering if this is where his life would end. The teens who found Darlene and Michael would never forget that haunting night. A chance encounter that meant they could summon help and opportunity for lives to be saved. Aged just 17 and 19 years old, all three witnessed scenes that would stay with them. Michael was in great pain with multiple gunshot wounds, and he was bleeding heavily. He needed immediate medical attention if he had any chance of survival. In the ambulance, Darlene's condition worsened. Medics performed CPR on her, desperately trying to keep her alive, but her injuries were too great. Darlene was pronounced dead at 12:38 a.m. as she arrived at Kaiser Hospital in Vallejo. Chillingly, exactly 2 minutes after Darlene had been pronounced dead at the hospital, police dispatcher Nancy Slover answered another call at the police department. It was unlike any call she had taken before.
The next call I got was about 12:40, and that's the call that I received from the man who was subsequently called Zodiac. He spoke in a monotone. It's like he had rehearsed it or was reading what he was saying. He had a very non-emotional voice. You know, his first words were, "I want to report a double murder. If you'll go 1 mile east on Columbus Parkway to the public park." And I said, "Yes, sir, we have a report of a shooting in that area. I still need to get your name and your location." And he said, "You'll find the kids in a brown car. They were shot with a 9mm Luger. And I also killed those kids last year." I got a very taunting, scary type creepy feeling from the call. And when he got to the end of his statement, it's hard for me to duplicate, but instead of just saying, "If you read my report, it means nothing, but if you hear, you know, if you could have heard, I can't explain it as well as I still hear it. You know, it was from somebody who was really out there. But his voice really changed when he came to goodbye. And it wasn't just goodbye. Now it may sound a little silly to people. It didn't to me at the time. But he said something like, "Goodbye." And he hangs up. And I'm just kind of sitting there thinking, oh my God.
Michael was rushed into surgery when he arrived at the hospital. Medics found he was wearing multiple layers of clothing, consisting of three pairs of trousers and three sweaters, over a long-sleeved shirt and a t-shirt underneath. He would go on to survive and recover from his injuries, therefore able to give detectives his account of what happened. At 2:35 a.m., Dean Farron arrived at Kaiser Hospital with his boss, Bill Lee, after being told Darlene had been shot. He was told the worst news possible about his wife's condition. Dean Farron broke down. A normal day for his family had become his worst nightmare, with no answers or reasons why. When officers had first arrived at the Blue Rock Springs scene, they'd found Darlene's Corvair, idle in a low gear with the headlights on. The engine hummed quietly as they took in the enormity of what they were looking at. Just like at Lake Herman Road, there was evidence of the shots fired. A total of 7 casings were found on the right side of Darlene's vehicle, where Michael said the shooter was standing. A further 2 casings were found on the floorboard, below the back seats. All the casings were 9mm and believed to have been fired from an automatic pistol. But it was the phone call to the police that sparked the most intrigue and scramble for evidence as to the identity of this killer. Officers determined the call was made from a payphone at the gas station on Springs Road, a location close to where Darlene lived, and just 2.5 miles from Blue Rock Springs. Only one witness aside from the teens who found the victims was able to give an account of what he heard on that night. George Bryant's father was the caretaker of the golf course at Blue Rock Springs, and George was at home around 800 feet from the parking lot where Michael and Darlene were shot. He reported hearing kids' laughter and then some firecrackers, which made sense to him, being July 4th. He said at close to midnight, however, he heard different sounds. These were sounds he was sure were gunshots. He said he heard one first and then more to follow. George reported what he heard to the police, just in case. But both he and the call handler thought it was most likely just fireworks celebrations. Neither of them could have predicted the truth. At Kaiser Hospital Intensive Care Unit, Michael lay gravely injured, but stable in his condition after surgery. Sedated, he could speak slowly and was still in a lot of pain with a wound directly to his mouth. At around 3 p.m., the day after the shootings, officers interviewed him at his bedside, trying to get a full account of what had happened the night before. Michael told them when the car first pulled up next to his car, he had asked Darlene if she knew the driver. Her response was, "Oh, never mind." He never would find out what she meant by this statement. Michael was able to give officers a description of the man who had shot them. He was a white male of a heavy build and around 5'8". He estimated around 26 to 30 years old. He said he was around 200 pounds with light brown, short, curly hair. Michael also noticed he was wearing a blue short sleeve shirt. He was only able to glimpse a side view of the killer's face. There was nothing notable about him. He was not wearing glasses, did not have a beard or a mustache, but he did have a large face. Detectives joined forces with those working on the Lake Herman Road murders, but leads in both cases were slow. Interviews with Darlene's friends and family produced some individuals of interest, who were all quickly ruled out as suspects. Neither family knew why their loved one would be targeted like this. Their killer remained elusive and protected by the cover of darkness. The police didn't have to wait long for the next chapter of this horrifying case. Just 27 days after Darlene and Michael had been brutally shot, three letters were sent to local newspapers. These letters were a channel for this killer to announce himself and lay his claim on the horror that had already taken place. He gave snippets of information to prove he was the killer before making threats and demands. He was vain and confident. He was a killer who had begun a deadly game where the rules were his and his alone.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.